We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 7. Lord Krishna instructs Uddhava, verses 45 to 74. Verse 45. Tejasvi tapasadipto dhritarsha tarabhajana sarvabhakshyopiyuktatma natate malam agnivat. Translation. Saintly persons become powerful by execution of austerities. Their consciousness is unshakable because they do not try to enjoy anything within the material world. Such naturally liberated sages accept foodstuffs that are offered to them by destiny, and if by chance they happen to eat contaminated food, they are not affected, just like fire, which burns up contaminated substances that are offered to it. Mukam karati vachalam bhangam langhayate giriyat pipantamam vande shri guru jinitarinam om agyana timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshirini jambyena tasmai shri guru. So if anybody doesn't have a chart for the 24 gurus, you can raise your hand and... Yes, you don't have? Okay. And anybody else? Oh, Nand Vrindavan needs one. You have it, okay. Nand Vrindavan needs one. Okay. So what do you remember from the last class, last Saturday, on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's disappearance day? Yes.
Guru
24 gurus, yes. Okay, anything else from... Yes, Adi Purush.
Krishna teaches Uddhava to see him everywhere, to seek him everywhere.
To seek him, yes. Krishna is telling Uddhava to seek him everywhere and teaching him also. How to see him, to seek, search for Krishna. And that is the purpose of Uddhava Gita. Somehow or other we have to find Krishna in everything we do and everywhere and in all the different yogas. And starting with the 24 gurus, we're seeing Krishna without in this world. Yes, anybody else? Yes. The earth is tolerant. We learned from the earth tolerance. What did we learn from the mountain? Selfless service. And from the tree. What?
Serving others,
okay. Also tolerance. Actually, 39 should be from the prana. I looked in one in the commentaries. It says the simple living, high thinking, which I wrote here. It's what you learn from the prana.
Prana,
yes. 39 should be what you learn from the prana. Simple living and high thinking. And verse 40-41, what do we learn from the wind? Detachment from
environment
and body. Detachment how from the body? How? What is the example of detachment from the body? How is it compared to the wind? Yes. 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 The wind is going through different areas and picking up different aromas. So the soul goes through different bodies, picks up different bodies, but it's detached. Yes? Oh, that's the sky now. Okay, we're getting to the sky. The sky is like a background. Everything, hurricanes are going on, and lightning and thunder, but the sky just remains the background. So the soul is the background, and so many hurricanes are going on in our life, and lightning and thunder, but we're just like the background for it. We're not really, has nothing to do with us. So the sky is like the soul. The soul is unchanged and unaffected by all the things that happen to us. And water? Sweet words of the sadhu. And soft and gentle is like water. Water is like that. And did so Lila Shuka, he did the, he tried to figure out the 24 elements, how they relate to the 24 gurus. But you didn't do all of them, actually. There's some you left out. And he repeated some. So he had like, it wasn't like one for one, but he was having mind for a lot of them, and different things were repeated. So did you try Adi Purush? Oh, you did. You could not do.
Actually, well, aroma and smell.
The bee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says that in a purport. I was also looking when I was studying. The aroma and smell is the bee, according to the purport, and also a verse they quote. We'll read it today, actually.
Okay, so then the bee could be the smell, aroma, you could attribute to the tree.
To the tree. Yeah. Well, I just put them together like Lila Shuka did. I put aroma and nose. Aroma and nose together. I just put them together with the bee. It is mentioned in the purport that the bee is that. He's attracted through the fragrance of the flower, and then it closes up at night, and then he's finished. Okay. So maybe you could send that, and then we could have the both of them. Maybe for next class. Maybe, yes. Send it to Mitra. And you could send yours to Mitra too. And then maybe she can print it. Or in between the class you can give it to her, and then we can have it for the next class, chapter 8. Okay, so yes. I was also trying. So when we go on, then I'll ask you. You can tell me if you have something. Well, fire is obvious. So we're starting with fire today. Yeah. Some are very stretched, yeah. The snake, there's actually the madhukari, the bee is also the hands, because you're only supposed to accept enough that fits in your hands. Anyway, when we get to that, we can discuss some more. So fire is like a sadhu, and because he can consume everything, and because he's done so many austerities, he's so strong in Krishna consciousness. As Srila Prabhupada said, the guru, he takes the sinful reactions of the disciple. He is just like fire in that sense, that he can burn up all the sinful reactions. I think this will come up in a verse later on. Yes, the next verse. So in the purport of 45, in the middle, it says, although Maya tries to defeat him by offering different material allurements, ultimately, these attractive material features are themselves defeated by the spiritual power of a saintly person. So what example did we hear just like that in a previous chapter of this canto? Who was that?
Naranarayana
Rishi, yes. Indra tried to send the beautiful girls, but they were all defeated by his beautiful girls, which were much nicer. Thus, one should never disrespect a spiritually advanced personality, but should worship him reverentially. To carelessly approach Krishna conscious personality is just like carelessly approaching fire, which immediately burns if not handled properly. The Lord does not excuse mistreatment of a pure devotee. Be careful when handling fire. So Dhruva Maharaj, he was like fire, and he was mistreated by his stepmother, and she didn't even know he was an advanced devotee, but she got the reaction. So we learned that saintly persons are unaffected by sin, just like fire burns up everything. In verse 46, a saintly person, just like fire, sometimes appears in a concealed form and at other times reveals himself. For the welfare of the conditioned souls who desire real happiness, a saintly person may accept the worshipable position of spiritual master. Thus, like fire, he burns to ashes all the past and future sinful reactions of his worshippers by mercifully accepting their offerings. So sometimes disciples think, oh, I'm doing a favor for my spiritual master by giving him a donation, giving him this. But actually, the guru is burning up all your karma from that donation. So the purport, a saintly person prefers to conceal his exalted spiritual position, but to instruct the suffering people of the world, he sometimes reveals his own greatness. This is compared to a fire that sometimes burns unnoticed beneath ashes and sometimes blazes openly. We have many wonderful devotees in our movement who are very humble and just go on doing their service, and we don't know how wonderful they are until they leave the planet, and then we realize, like this lady who just left her body that was out in front distributing books, and Hari Priya, yeah. And then we found out she left while she was chanting her Gayatri Mantra and went back to Godhead. So, ordinary, you would just look at her, you would think, oh, yeah, okay. Little old lady, and she's pretty determined. But actually, she was a great soul, you know, like fire. So if you mistreat such a devotee, then you will have to suffer. So let's see what Shabhakti Siddhanta Saraswati says about this verse. Devotees do not like to disclose their own glories, and so they are like fire covered by ashes. Sometimes in order to teach people, devotees reveal their glories just like a blazing fire. Sometimes they act as a spiritual master for the benefit of ordinary people. As fire accepts gifts such as ghee offered by worshippers, devotees accept the glorification offered by their worshippers. In this way, they burn to ashes just like fire the most coveted objects possessed by materially absorbed worshippers without exhibiting the slightest desire to enjoy them. Okay, so when you glorify spiritual master and he accepts it, then this is Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati is explaining what is actually happening there. So the fire is compared to the sadhu in two verses. Now in this verse, the fire is compared to the supersoul. Just as fire manifests differently in pieces of wood of different sizes and qualities, the omnipotent supreme soul, having entered the bodies of higher and lower forms, life forms created by his own potency, appears to assume the identity of each. So in the purport, it said, although the Supreme Lord is within everything, everything is not the Lord. So this is the mistake the pantheists make. By the mode of goodness, the Lord creates the exalted material bodies of demigods and Brahmins, and by expanding the mode of ignorance, he similarly creates the bodies of animals, shudras, and other lower forms of life. Lord enters all of the superior and inferior creations, but he remains Vibhu, the all-powerful personality of Godhead. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains, although fire is present within smoldering wood, it blazes forth when we stir the wood around. Similarly, although the personality of Godhead is indirectly present everywhere, when we chant and hear his glories with love and devotion, the Lord is stirred into manifestation and directly appears before his devotees. So the Lord is everywhere. But when we chant, then he blazes forth. That's a wonderful way to understand this verse, just like fire. When we chant the holy name, then we ignite the fire and the Lord appears. So next is the waxing and waning moon. The soul is like the moon. The various phases of one's material life, beginning with birth and culminating in death, are all properties of the body and do not affect the soul, just as the apparent waxing and waning of the moon does not affect the moon itself. Such changes are enforced by the imperceptible movements of time. Purport. The body undergoes six changes: birth, growth, maintenance, production of byproducts, dwindling, and death. Similarly, the moon appears to grow, diminish, and finally disappear. Since moonlight is a lunar reflection of sunlight, it is understood the moon itself does not grow or diminish. Rather, we perceive the reflection of the moon in various phases. Similarly, the eternal soul is not born, nor does it die, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, na jayate mriyate va kadachit. We perceive the reflection of the soul in the form of the gross material body and the subtle mind, which undergo various material changes. So a very interesting comparison of the soul to the moon. So if you think of your body, and when you see it moving and everything, then that means you're seeing the reflection of the soul. When you're seeing the mind changing and going through so many things, then you're seeing the reflection of the soul. But all those changes are just enforced by the movements of time. There, as it says here with the moon. Let's see what Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati says. The wheel of time is unseen. In the present conditional state, the living entities cannot understand what undivided or eternal time is. It is a time factor that causes the waxing and waning of the moon. From this example, it is understood the pure spirit soul neither increases nor decreases. Rather, it is a material body, which is obtained from the temporary material nature that develops and then dwindles. Under the influence of time, material body is born, remains for some time, then dies. As the waxing and waning of the moon is an effect of reflecting the rays of the sun, so all living entities are manifested in various species by the will of the Supreme Lord. So very interesting. The soul is unseen and time is unseen. That is forcing the changes of the body and forcing the changes of the mind, but all being pushed by time. So that is compared to the waxing and waning of the moon. And now we're going back to fire. Again, we heard about fire and then the moon, and now again, fire. The flames of a fire appear and disappear at every moment, and yet this creation and destruction is not noticed by the ordinary observer. So when you look at a flame, you don't think, oh, it is being created, destroyed. Some part of this flame is being destroyed. It's every moment. You just look and you see the same flame. You don't see any difference. Second moment to moment, you don't see any difference. But actually what's happening is described in this verse. It's always being created and destroyed. Similarly, the mighty waves of time flow constantly like the powerful currents of a river and imperceptibly cause the birth, growth, and death of innumerable material bodies. Yet the soul, who is thus constantly forced to change its position, cannot perceive the actions of time. So our body, within our body, there are cells that are being created and destroyed right at this very moment. But it looks like the same body to us. If we look at the body, we don't see how it's being created and destroyed at every moment. So that's compared to the flames of a fire. That at every moment, and water, I think later on it might come, that if you look at a flowing river, then you think it's just the same water, but actually it's different water that you're seeing. At every moment, the water is changing. It's not the same water. You're seeing the river, but the water is different. You're seeing the water coming from the upstream, and then it's here, and then it's gone. So it's not the same water that you're seeing. It's not the same flame, and it's not the same body. So all of this is, they're trying to show us how the soul is different from the body. We'll go in the purport about three lines down. Thus the sage proceeds with his analysis, but returns to the example of fire to illustrate the need for renunciation. So since everything is changing at every moment, therefore we should not be attached to the body, because it is always changing and it's not us. The soul is remaining the same. Material body is certainly an ephemeral and phantasmagorial manifestation of the Lord's external potency. The flames of a fire constantly take birth and disappear, yet we perceive the fire as a continuous reality. Similarly, the soul is a continuous reality, although his material bodies appear and disappear constantly by the influence of time. It is said the most astonishing thing is that no one thinks they will die. Because the soul is eternal, the living entity is prone to accept any fleeting situation as permanent, forgetting that his eternal nature can be truly experienced only in the eternal atmosphere of the spiritual sky. If one is convinced of this fact, he develops the quality of vairagya, or detachment from material illusion. So fire, the moon, fire, and now the sun. How a sadhu is actually renounced. And how to remain unentangled, although you're in contact with sense objects. So the sun will teach us that. Verse 50, just as the sun evaporates large quantities of water by its potent rays and later returns the water to the earth in the form of rain, similarly, a saintly person accepts all types of material objects with his material senses. And at the appropriate time, when the proper person has approached him to request them, he returns such material objects. Thus, both in accepting and giving up the objects of the senses, he is not entangled. So Sridhar Swami used to say, after 1 month, if you haven't used something, you should give it away. That was his philosophy. You have something for 1 month and you haven't used it for that 1 month, then it's time to get rid of it. That was a very Interesting. And of course, he's sannyasi, so he's teaching us. Grihasthas, for grihasthas, it may be 1 year that you keep something. And then finally, but don't keep it for 10 years. Of course, if grihasthas in Krishna consciousness, they're changing their houses quite a bit. So you can't even keep things that long. There was a joke with the Gurukulis that, you know, the worst question you can ask a Gurukuli is, where are you from? Because the Gurukuli, he's said, well, I was born in, I was born in Bombay, and then we moved to Chicago for 2 years, and then we went to Pennsylvania, and then after 3 years we went here, and then for 10 minutes we went here, and a half hour we went here, and then we traveled all over the world, and then after 15 years, now we're here for maybe 2 years. And so it's like that. Devotees are always traveling. And you can't keep anything. You have to keep leaving things behind wherever you go. Of course, you may keep things all over the world also. You may keep something here and something there and something there, but it's very difficult to keep anything. And also, like I was just traveling the last 5 months, and every trip, every time I went on the airplane, I thought of what I didn't need again, because you have a weight limit on the airplane. And so it really makes you reduce to think what you think you need is actually not much. It's not that much what you really actually need. And then you're always thinking how to reduce. And when you keep traveling, then that you realize that, what you really need when you keep traveling. And you don't need so much. So purport, a Krishna-conscious person never feels proprietorship over the opulences entrusted to him by Lord Krishna for spreading the Krishna-consciousness movement. Devotees of Lord Krishna should not merely accumulate material wealth, but should distribute the opulences of Lord Krishna in such a way that the Krishna-conscious movement spreads unlimitedly. This is a lesson to be learned from the sun. So the sun, how to accept, how to give away, is taught to us by the sun. In the summer, the sun takes the water. In the rainy season, the sun gives the water back in such a way that everyone is benefited. And if you keep, actually, Srila Prabhupada said for grihasthas, 50%, of course, now it is... after studying what Prabhupada said, and in many places he said 50% of your accumulated wealth. It's not that, you know, if you don't even make enough to maintain yourself, then that 50% you give away. But generally it's 50% of the profit that you make, or 50% of your accumulated wealth. So if you accumulate money, then what happens? What do we learn from First Canto? If you accumulate money and keep it, Kali will enter. It is one of the places where Kali can enter. So, and that we see from these people who win the lottery. They get loads of money, and then it's a cause of distress for them because they don't know. Yes?
In the last few years, I think two people were killed in Great Britain after winning the lottery.
After winning the lottery.
By relatives.
They were killed by relatives. Two people after winning the lottery. Yeah, and if they're not killed, they commit suicide. Or if they don't commit suicide, then yeah, they have a heart attack. Prabhupada said one guy won the lottery when he got the news, he had a heart attack and died. And then there's another story. Somebody in their paper they were telling about somebody won the lottery, and he gave it all to his granddaughter, and then she had an overdose of drugs and died. And anyways. This is what happens. So therefore, we give up it because now we have a very short life. And if wealth is used for a good purpose, then it's our ticket to the spiritual world, if we use it for Krishna. So that's the lesson we learn from the sun. In verse 51, another lesson we learned. Even when reflected in various objects, the sun is never divided, nor does it merge into its reflection. Only those with dull brains who consider the sun in this way. Similarly, although the soul is reflected through different material bodies, the soul remains undivided and non-material. Okay. So how to understand this? It's not there's one soul in all the bodies, but what they're saying here is that the soul has the same quality in all the bodies, although you have different false designations covering the soul, but the soul is the same in all the bodies. So these designations, they are false. And this division of these false designations, this is what is illusion. And this is the illusion that I am white, I am black, I am American, I'm Indian. This is the illusion. So this is false. So Vishnu Chakravarti explains this. What is the reality and what is the illusion here? 51. The sun may be reflected off various surfaces and thus appear in a variety of ways, but we know that the sun itself is far beyond such manifestations and has nothing to do with them. In the same way, spirit souls are reflected through their material bodies, which exhibit myriad designations, such as white, black, male, female, young, and old. The soul's eternal constitutional position is something far beyond these temporary manifestations, however, and has nothing to do with them. So our eternal constitutional position is servant of Krishna. This is the reality. And the illusion is that we are divided by our bodies. This is the illusion. The soul is one. We all have the same family. But so we are not divided. We are together as one because we all are servants of Krishna. So now we hear the story of the foolish pigeon. One should never indulge in excessive affection or concern for anyone or anything. Otherwise, one will have to experience great suffering, just like the foolish pigeon. We'll go to the end of the purport. This is 52. If our affection or attachment for others is based on bodily sense gratification in the name of society, friendship, and love, that excessive unwanted affection, atisneha, will cause burning pain at the time of breaking or destruction of the relationship. Now the story of the foolish pigeon will be narrated. A similar story is described in the 7th canto, 2nd chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, told by Yamraj to the mourning widows of King Suyagya. There was once a pigeon who lived in the forest along with his wife. He had built a nest within a tree and lived there for several years in her company. The two pigeons were very much devoted to their household duties, their hearts being tied together by sentimental affection. They were each attracted by the other's glances, bodily features, and states of mind. Thus, they completely bound each other in affection. Purport, the male and female pigeon were so attracted to each other they could not tolerate even a moment's separation from one another. This is called Bhagavad Vismriti, or forgetfulness of the Supreme Lord and attachment to dead matter. The living entity has an eternal love for the Lord, but when perverted, that love is manifested as false material affection. A pale reflection of actual pleasure thus becomes the foundation of a false life based on forgetfulness of the absolute truth. Naively trusting in the future, they carried out their acts of resting, verse 55, sitting, walking, standing, conversing, playing, eating, and so forth, as a loving couple among the trees of the forest. Whenever she desired anything, O king, the she-pigeon would flatteringly cajole her husband, and he in turn would gratify her by faithfully doing whatever she wanted, even with great personal difficulty. Thus, he could not control his senses in her association. So we didn't know these things are going on between the birds as well. We look at these birds and we didn't understand that they are very much like us. Then the female pigeon experienced her first pregnancy. When the time arrived, the chaste lady delivered a number of eggs within the nest in the presence of her husband. When the time was ripe, baby pigeons with tender limbs and feathers created by the inconceivable potencies of the Lord were born from those eggs. Verse 58... Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says, when the conditioned souls become averse to the Supreme Lord, then the Supreme Lord spreads the network of illusion in all their activities to increase their aversion to his service. Those who do not display an inclination for service of the Supreme Lord are awarded suitable mentalities according to their desires and activities. In this way, they pose themselves as enjoyers and become busy in trying to enjoy this material world. So this is the fruit of aversion that we're hearing about here, is according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. The two pigeons became most affectionate to their children and took great pleasure in listening to their awkward chirping, which sounded very sweet to the parents. Thus, with love, they began to raise the little birds who were born of them. Purport. This is by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. The conditioned souls who are averse to the service of Krishna experience great pleasure hearing the sweet words of their children, which are the fruit of their aversion to the service of the Lord. Ooh, he's very heavy. But because that pleasure is not eternal, that very pleasure will one day become the cause of their distress. The child grows up, leaves home, and you're all alone with your mind. So we'll read something else to counteract Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, so we won't get carried away. Actually, for verse 52. Okay. Thank you. Oh, is this yours? Oh, thank you. Okay. There is a comment by Satyaraj Prabhu. So Satyaraj is writing, thinking of his audience of non-devotees in mind when he wrote this book. So let us hear how he takes this. This is from verse 52. So atisneha, again, excessive affection. It is not one should renounce love of family and friends and all things material, but rather one should see this love in proper perspective. So that's his comment, which is, I mean, otherwise people are going to think we're really cruel. Ideally, it should be seen as subservient to love of God and the spiritual element. In fact, selfless love, true love, is only possible if one transcends the bodily concept of life. Otherwise, love is motivated by self-interest. Yeah, we see that especially in India, in the West, we don't think like that, but in India, the parents think, oh, my child will grow up and he will get a nice job and then he will take care of me as I am taking care of him now. He will take care of me when I am old. In the West, we that illusion is not there, because we know the child will leave home and take care, and lucky if he can take care of himself, what to speak of us. Yes, and so that is... I asked one of my godbrothers, Prabhupada disciple, who is Indian. I said, so your children, now you're old, your children are growing up, they're taking care of you? He said, no, they are coming and asking me for money. So, anyway, what to do? And it's Kali Yuga. So verse 60, the parent birds became very joyful by observing the soft wings of their children, their chirping, their lovely innocent movements around the nest, and their attempts to jump up and fly. Seeing their children happy, the parents were also happy. Their hearts bound to each other by affection, the foolish birds, completely bewildered by the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu, continued to take care of the young offspring who had been born of them. 62. One day, the two heads of the family went out to find food for the children. Being very anxious to feed their offspring properly, they wandered all over the forest for a long time. At that time, a certain hunter who happened to be wandering through the forest saw the young pigeons moving about near their nest. Spreading out his net, he captured them all. The pigeon and his wife were always anxious for the maintenance of their children, and they were wandering in the forest for that purpose. Having obtained proper food, they now returned to their nest. When the lady pigeon caught sight of her own children trapped within the hunter's net, she was overwhelmed with anguish, and crying out, she rushed toward them as they cried out to her in return. A lady pigeon had always allowed herself to be bound by the ropes of intense material affection, and thus her mind was overwhelmed by anguish. Being in the grip of the illusory energy of the Lord, she completely forgot herself And rushing forward to her helpless children, she was immediately bound in the hunter's net. Seeing his own children, who were more dear to him than life itself, fatally bound in the hunter's net, along with his dearmost wife, whom he considered equal in every way to himself, the poor male pigeon began to lament wretchedly. The male pigeon said, "Alas, just see how I am now destroyed. I am obviously a great fool, for I did not properly execute pious activities. I could not satisfy myself, nor could I fulfill the purpose of life. My dear family, which was the basis of my religiosity, economic development, and sense gratification, is now hopelessly ruined." Purport. Sridhar Swami explains the word achiptasya indicates that the pigeon was not satisfied with the sense gratification he had achieved. Although he was completely attached to his wife, children, and nest, he could not sufficiently enjoy them since there is ultimately no satisfaction in such things. Akritarthasya indicates that his hopes and dreams for future expansion of his sense gratification were now also ruined. People commonly refer to their home, sweet home, as their nest. And money put aside for future sense gratification is called a nest egg. Therefore, all of the lovebirds of the material world should clearly note how their so-called wife, children, and fortune will all be dragged away in the hunter's net. In other words, death will finish everything. 69. My wife and I were an ideal match. She always faithfully obeyed me and, in fact, accepted me as her worshipful deity. But now, seeing her children lost and her home empty, she has left me behind and gone to heaven with our saintly children. Now, I am a wretched person living in an empty home. My wife is dead. My children are dead. Why should I possibly want to live? My heart is so pained by separation from my family that life itself has become simply suffering. So Prabhupada, he was giving a lecture one time, I remember, and he said, at this point he took sannyas. But no. No, he didn't take sannyas. As the father pigeon wretchedly stared at his poor children trapped in the net and on the verge of death, pathetically struggling to free themselves, his mind went blank. Thus he himself fell into the hunter's net. The cruel hunter, having fulfilled his desire by capturing the head pigeon, his wife, and all of their children, set off for his own home. In this way, one who is too attached to family life becomes disturbed at heart. Like the pigeon, he tries to find pleasure in mundane sex attraction. Busily engaged in maintaining his own family, the miserly person is fated to suffer greatly along with all his family members. The doors of liberation are open wide to one who has achieved human life. But if a human being simply devotes himself to family life like the foolish bird in the story, then he is to be considered as one who has climbed to a high place only to trip and fall down. So Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati has a comment. So we'll hear the two sides of the story again. This is verse 74. So Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati says, to see the earth, air, sky, water, fire, moon, sun, and pigeon with mere knowledge of the external world will only increase one's thirst for sense gratification. But with sharp internal vision, if one considers them as worshipable rather than objects of his enjoyment, then his inclination toward Krishna will increase and he will become eligible to attain liberation even while living in this world. So two ways of seeing the world, earth, air, water, fire. You can see them as your objects to enjoy, or you can see them as your worshipable objects to learn a lesson from your gurus. So how the things of this world can elevate us in Krishna consciousness, that's the vision of the devotee. So even he may have a family, and he's thinking, how can our family be elevated in Krishna consciousness? So here is another perception from Satyaraj Prabhu from his book, Krishna's Other Song. Not that we disregard family life or avoid it, but we should realize death is inevitable and there will be separation. We must pursue family life with proper perspective. family life can be an asset on the spiritual path or detrimental. So he's has a balanced view here. Because his book is for the non-devotees. Family life, if it is obsessively our prime focus, eclipsing our love of God, it becomes a distraction. But if family serves the function of pursuing the spirit, and we see them as spirit souls, and we love them in that way, they become an asset. And Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Saraswati was saying the same thing, actually, in his last comment, that it's how we see. If we see them in relation to Krishna, then they will elevate. We will all be elevated together, and they will elevate us. So here I have your paper on how the earth is the earth, air is air, sky is sky, water is water, fire is fire, tree aroma, moon is the mind, sun is eyes.
Actually, I just after your explanation, I thought moon and fire could be the 25th element of soul.
Yes, moon and fire could be the 25th element of soul.
Sparks, yeah.
Flames of the fire are like the soul. Yes, the soul can be there, the 25th element. Sun, the eyes. Pigeon, the genitals. Okay. So, do we have any questions or comments on this chapter? And we will go on to the next chapter because we have time now. Anything on this chapter or these gurus? Let us review. What is fire? What do we learn from fire? Yeah? Not to be contaminated. What else? Flames appear and disappear like the body appears and disappears. What else?
I have a question.
You have a question, okay.
How can I learn from the fire not to be contaminated by gifts? I mean, I'm not fire.
Right.
How do I actually...
No, you learn to see the spiritual master in that light. He is like fire. And he is not contaminated. That was the... That they appear... And also, that's like the fire is sometimes concealed and sometimes appears. So we can see that a pure devotee is like fire. So you should not criticize the pure devotee. You should see him, that he can burn all the contamination, even if something... He touches some contaminated thing. Just like Lord Chaitanya said, if you see Nityananda going into the wine house, then you should understand he's not contaminated by that. Yes? He accepts gifts used in service of Krishna. Fire burns the reactions. That reminded me of Jayananda, that one time one of his godbrothers went to visit him, and Jayananda took him to the bar where people were drinking. And he said, I want to show you some friends of mine. So they walk into the bar, and then all these drunkards immediately stand up when they see Jayananda. And they all come to him, and they have a bag of vegetables. He said, oh, we all put in our money, and we bought these vegetables for you. We all chipped in to buy these vegetables for you. And anyway, they were accepting Jayananda like their guru. So if Jayananda walks in the bar, then he doesn't become contaminated, but he burns up all the sins of those drunkards by his appearance. Yes?
I was sick. The first time I was not sick because it was for the purpose of preaching.
Got sick from the ice cream. Yeah. Prabhupada used, when devotees were new in India, then we used to eat at life members' houses all the time, and it wasn't. It was very difficult. We would get sick sometimes. Prabhupada wouldn't, but we would. Because we weren't like him. We would get sick, and Prabhupada would. One time, I think Śrīla Kīrti tells the story, yes, that they went to one life member's house and Prabhupada was there and everybody was eating, and then the next morning so many devotees couldn't get up for Mangalarti, and Prabhupada asked Śrīla Kīrti, he said, yes, they got sick. He says, yes, I noticed. And Shri Kirti said, I didn't eat so much. He said, Prabhupada said, no, but you ate four puris. And he was listing what everybody was eating. And Pradyumna had too much sabji. The Prabhupada was there and he was watching everybody eat, but he noticed what they were eating. You can't cheat the spiritual master. He notices everything. Yeah, we are not like that. We cannot imitate the pure devotee in many things, and that's one of them. We cannot imitate him in eating. We cannot imitate him. Of course, it used to be a principle that we wouldn't eat in any house unless they were life members, so they would have to become life members so that they could invite us. So that was another thing we used to do. Well, sorry, unless you're a life member, we can't eat in your house. They have to become life members. Any other questions or comments on this chapter 7? Yes, I have your list. Yeah, the moon could be the mind or it could be the soul. 25th element, and fire also. Okay. So we go to chapter 8. We're going to hear more of the 24 gurus. Verse 1. The saintly Brahmana said, O king, the embodied living entity automatically experiences unhappiness in heaven or hell. Similarly, happiness will also be experienced even without seeking it. Therefore, a person of intelligent discrimination does not make any endeavor to obtain such material happiness. So which guru are we going to hear about now? Although it's not mentioned here, it will be mentioned.
Python.
The Python, very good. Python simply accepts whatever comes as his destiny. Purport. One should not uselessly waste his life pursuing material sense gratification, because a specific quantity of material happiness will automatically come to one as a result of one's past and present fruitive activities. This lesson is learned from the Ajagara, or Python, who lies down and accepts for his maintenance whatever comes of its own accord. Remarkably, in both material heaven and hell, happiness and unhappiness come automatically due to our previous activities, although the proportions of happiness and unhappiness certainly vary. Either in heaven or hell, one may eat, drink, sleep, and have sex life, but these activities, being based on the material body, are temporary and inconsequential. An intelligent person should see, even in the best material situation, is actually a punishment for previous unlawful activities executed outside the scope of loving devotional service to God. So there's a nice verse from First Canto. It says the same thing. Tasyaiva heto prayate tikovido nalabhyate yat pramatam upayata talabhyate dukavarandata sukham kalena savatra kabirarangasa. Persons who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end which is not obtainable even by wandering from the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest planet, Patala. As far as happiness derived from sense enjoyment is concerned, it can be obtained automatically in course of time, just as in course of time we obtain miseries, even though we do not desire them. So Prabhupada explains we should just try to develop our Krishna consciousness. That's the purport of this. It's not like we should just... Of course, as far as material enjoyment, we should be like the Python, but as far as our process of sadhana, we should not be like the Python. Of course, we accept whatever comes, but we should endeavor. We should endeavor for that. And that is that verse, which says we should endeavor for Krishna consciousness, but not for anything else. So Prabhupada says that we cannot improve our material condition, and the process of improvement is another miserable condition. So trying to improve is going to make you miserable also, trying to change your material situation. However, if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distresses of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. So Krishna promises, Konti apati janihi name bhakta pranashyate. Son of Kunti, declared boldly, my devotee never perishes. So these things, this is the lesson of the python. And we will read what Śrīla Bhakti Siddhānta Saraswati says, only one sentence from his comments on verse 1. Rather than pursue the path of fruitive activities for attaining heavenly planets or becoming sense enjoyers in contact with temporary material objects, intelligent people should become inclined towards the service of Kamadev, Vishnu, who is the director and aim of our senses. So when we realize who is the real Kamadev, then we can also be happy. We try to serve his senses and our senses are happy. So then the python. Verse 2, following the example of the python, one should give up material endeavors and accept for one's maintenance food that comes of its own accord, whether such food be delicious or tasteless, ample or meager. So this is very, very difficult because the tongue is the most uncontrollable of all. And Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta also comments on this. The python is satisfied with whatever comes of its own accord. Instead of endeavoring for sense enjoyment, it remains satisfied with any condition of life, does not try to eat palatable food or too much food, does not try to manipulate the senses, mind, and speech for attaining happiness. Instead, the python always displays its gravity. The lesson to be learned from the python is those who are inclining towards the service of Lord Krishna should not be anxious to gratify their senses. They should not be bound up by the urges of belly and genitals. One should remain indifferent to such propensities. Eating too much, collecting too much, atyahara prayasascha. So this is atyahara, over-endeavoring for mundane things, and eating too much, collecting too much, endeavoring too much, are not favorable for the service of the Supreme Lord. So nectar of instruction, verse 2. Atyahara prayasascha. Rather than seeing the python as a mere snake, one should consider it to be a spiritual master. Indeed, one who can see how the Supreme Lord is present everywhere must be considered a Mahabhagavat. Only those who are fully surrendered to the Supreme Lord are actually sober and qualified to serve the Supreme Lord. They are like the python who is never agitated for sense enjoyment. So the python. Who else in our spiritual line was like the python? Can you think of somebody? Yes? Gaurakishordas Babaji, okay. Anybody else? This one. He's giving us instructions. I don't know. Was he like that? Yes. It was him who Prahlad met. He was doing the python. So he actually practiced what he preached.
What was his name?
Dattatreya. That's Dattatreya, yeah. When Prahlad met him, he was lying like the python, and he was very fat. And Prahlad said, how are you so fat, and you don't endeavor for anything? Yes. So this is the Ajagara.
Marvendrapuri.
Who? Rishabhdev. Bilvamangal Thakur. Also, he was just sitting there blind. He couldn't endeavor even if he wanted to. What can a blind person do?
You can see the guy there near Krishna Balaramji. There's the guy near Krishna Balaramji who's trying to practice.
Oh, yeah?
The guy has been there for, I don't know, a day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, is he near Krishna Balaramji? Sometimes I see him on the road.
On the road, yes.
On the road. Yeah, like a python.
Do you think he's actually trying to practice being a python, or he's just not
crazy?
There?
Sometimes he acts like a reasonable person, but more often than not.
Jed Bharat would be.
Jed Bharat. Yeah. Jed Bharat. So actually, that man on the road is.
We don't know.
It could be a python.
That's the practice that he's.
Okay, that could be his sadhana. Okay, and you agree. All of you who live on that road or walk that road to your house. Yes.
I saw one person in the bank of.
There's. You don't know. But on the Perikama Road, between the main road and Krishna Balaramchi, there's a man who lies on the street. Yeah. And they're talking about him.
He used to live on the hospice land in that old building.
And sometimes he would stay outside when it got him up. But most of his stays down towards Krishna Balaramchi.
Yeah.
Once I was up vegetable shopping, and he starts chanting wonderful Vaishnava bhajan. And I just, you know, I stopped and I listened. And then some Vrijabasi said, it's very cold, he needs a blanket. I mean, he was singing, he wasn't asking for anything.
Right.
So I went to the door and got him a blanket. And he was sitting, I found him finally, because he doesn't always sit in one place.
Right.
I found him. And I got down from the rickshaw and put the blanket in front of him and paid my obeisances. And he wouldn't accept it. But I just kept on putting it in front of him, and then he took it. But even then...
Yeah.
Some devotees say that when they are in a good consciousness, he seems to be terrible. But when they're not in good consciousness, he seems to be swearing at them and mocking them.
So he reflects your state of consciousness, this one.
Kind of like detects that whether you are sincere or not.
Yeah.
Some people say that.
Okay.
When Purushottam Mas, Narendra was doing only one. Dandavat Parakram on the Vrindavan Parakram.
Uh-huh.
And this was the year when there were a lot of worms on the road. He actually had somebody go before him scooping the worms out. So at one point he was resting, and he rested right there with the Avadhut. He said that Avadhut carried on one of the most intelligent conversations he ever had with anybody in Vrindavan in all those years.
Okay, so don't judge. We have a python among us. We do have a python. I mean, I seen him, and I just go the other side of the street usually. And I think. But yeah. Okay, here we go. Verse 3: If at any time food does not come, then a saintly person should fast for many days without making endeavor. He should understand that by God's arrangement he must fast. Thus, following the example of the python, he should remain peaceful and patient. Purport. If by God's arrangement one is forced to suffer material hardship, then one should think, due to my past sinful activity, I am now being punished. In this way, God is mercifully making me humble. The word shayita means one should remain peaceful and patient without mental agitation. Dishtabuk means one must accept the personality of Godhead as a supreme controller and not foolishly give up one's faith due to material inconvenience. Tate nukambam susamikshamana bunjana evatma kritam vipakam. A devotee of the Lord always accepts material hardship as the mercy of Lord Krishna. Thus he becomes eligible for supreme liberation. Not easy to be a python. Actually, you think it's easy. All you have to do is lie there, right? No. It's very difficult. You can see that example of that person who is living like a pirate. It's not an easy job. Verse 4, a saintly person should remain peaceful and materially inactive, maintaining his body without much endeavor. Even though possessed of full sensual, mental, and physical strength, a saintly person should not become active for material gain, but rather should always remain alert to his actual self-interest. So here the inactivity is for material things. Otherwise, spiritually, we should be active. Purport. The word vita nidra in this verse is very significant. Nidra means sleep or ignorance, and vita means freed from. In other words, a transcendentalist should always be awake to his eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and should carefully cultivate Krishna consciousness. So we have to be active spiritually. Being confident of his relationship with the Lord, he should not endeavor for his personal maintenance, knowing that the Lord is protecting him in all respects. So that's what it means to be a python. Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur states, the example of the python is given so that one will not uselessly waste his time in bodily maintenance. So here is the lesson of the python. Not to endeavor materially, because the happiness and distress are predestined. But you should endeavor spiritually. One should not think, however, the purpose of life is to lie on the ground like a python or to make a show of starving the body. The example of the python should not encourage one to become completely inactive. One should rather become active in spiritual advancement and inactive in material sense gratification. If one becomes completely inactive, that is certainly nidra, or darkness of ignorance, in which one remains asleep to his identity as an eternal servant of the personality of Godhead. A transcendentalist is eager to execute his service to the Lord, and therefore he's grateful when the Lord provides material facilities for such service. Mere renunciation of the material world is falgu vairagya, or an immature stage of spiritual understanding. One must come to the stage of yukta vairagya, engaging everything in the service of Lord Krishna. It is our practical experience. A devotee absorbed in spreading Krishna consciousness automatically receives all facilities for his personal maintenance. Yes. And you should all try it. If you haven't tried it, yes.
You know, a small instant, when Banu Maharaj, somebody gave rice to him, and they went to take some sambar, like dal. But he's caught up with some other devotees, he's talking. Banu Maharaj took only rice and then he cut up. He didn't ask anything more.
Oh, Banu Maharaj didn't ask for the sambar. I think some devotees are doing this ajagaravrat. If you don't offer them, they won't eat.
He came back, sorry, he's begging sorry. And I said, no, okay, you give, it's okay.
Yes, some devotees, they don't tell, but they're doing it. They're doing this vrat.
They don't ask, they just take
whatever you give them, yeah. And if you don't give them, then they won't eat. They just eat what you give them. Yes, I've heard of others, examples. Devotees are doing that. Our devotees. Gotcha. Could be. So verse 5, now we are going to be in the water again, but different kind of water, the ocean. So you have on your list for snake, feet. Yeah, I would agree. Feet, legs, that you don't run after enjoyments. The working senses we have to have also. Okay. Ocean, verse 5. A saintly sage is happy and pleasing in his external behavior, whereas internally he is most grave and thoughtful. Because his knowledge is immeasurable and unlimited, he is never disturbed, and thus in all respects he is like the tranquil waters of the unfathomable and unsurpassable ocean. So the ocean is grave and undisturbed and peaceful, unfathomable, unsurpassable. So many qualities of the ocean that a saintly person has. Purport. Even in the midst of great distress, a self-realized sage does not lose control of himself, nor is his spiritual knowledge lost. Thus he is akshobhya, or undisturbed. His mind is fixed on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is a reservoir of unlimited spiritual bliss, and having linked his consciousness with the Supreme Consciousness, his knowledge cannot be measured. So akshobhya, undisturbed, because in the midst of distress, he doesn't lose himself. And he's immeasurable. What is immeasurable about the sadhu? His knowledge. A pure devotee, having taken shelter of the Lord's lotus feet, possesses great spiritual power. Therefore, he cannot be surpassed or overwhelmed. So that he's unsurpassable, like the ocean, because of his spiritual power. He's immeasurable, his knowledge, and he's undisturbed because even in distress, he doesn't lose control. In fact, having developed his spiritual body, he's not affected by the deteriorating actions of time. Although outwardly he's friendly and pleasing to everyone, internally his mind is fixed in the absolute truth and no one can understand his actual purpose or plan. So that's the gravity of the ocean. Nobody can understand the pure devotee. As Śrīla Kīrti was telling stories, he was saying that Śrīla Prabhupāda would respond differently at different times to different people. And in the same question, let's see, One question comes to my mind. I don't know if I can remember it. He was asking why you should accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And someone said, they were saying different answers, and the right answer was, because Bhagavad Gita says so. Then another time he asked the same question, so the devotee said, okay, I got the answer. And he said that answer, and Prabhupada said, no, it's because you have experience. You have experienced in your life, Krishna. So he would give different answers to the same question sometimes. So nobody can understand the mind of the pure devotee. Unfathomable in gravity. No one can understand his purpose or plan. Prabhupada would make a plan and then he would change it. Even the most intelligent human being cannot understand the mental activities of a self-realized devotee who has given up material life based on lust and greed and taken shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord. Why can't they understand? Even the most intelligent human being, why can't they understand the mind of a devotee? They're so intelligent. Why can't they understand?
The pure devotee is not acting on the mental or intellectual.
Yes, he's not acting on their platform. It's beyond the mind. He's acting on the spiritual level. And sometimes Prabhupada would answer questions on the spiritual level and not according to their intelligence or mind. He would just answer differently. And he would think, what does that have to do with the question? But that's it. It's how it is. If you remember the prayers of personified Vedas and the question how to understand, how can something that is material understand something that is beyond? And then the answer was something completely different that Shukadeva Goswami gave. So it's hard to understand. But actually, according to the Acharyas, he answered the question. So then, let's see, Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, his comment. Oh, this and the next verse describe the lesson to be learned from the ocean. A self-realized soul is as grave as the ocean because he does not allow anyone to understand his intentions. A saintly person is thus unfathomable and does not reveal his mentality to others. Now he describes, he is unconquerable because his prowess is difficult to overcome. Now he gives another thing. He is insurmountable because even when put into great difficulty, he does not waver from his determination to remain in Krishna consciousness. Insurmountable. He does not reveal his mind to others, and others do not agitate him because he's conquered the urges of the mind and the senses, as you also said. So this is Vishnu Chakravarti's understanding. Now, the ocean had all these wonderful qualities. We're back in the purport. Such a great soul can be compared to the mighty ocean. Innumerable powerful rivers plunge into the ocean, but the ocean remains calm and peaceful. Thus a saintly person is understood to be like the ocean, pleasing, unfathomable, grave, unsurpassable, unlimited, and unshakable. Okay, so we have these words. Let's review. How is he unfathomable? How is the pure devotee? Yes? No one knows his intention. That is also grave. How is he unsurpassable?
His determination level.
Determination. Good. In difficulties. How is he unlimited?
He has unlimited knowledge, spiritual knowledge.
Spiritual power.
Knowledge, yeah. Unshakable. That we also heard. So, now another quality of the ocean. He is undisturbed in abundance and scarcity. Verse 6. During the rainy season, the swollen rivers rush into the ocean. And during the dry summer, the rivers, now shallow, severely reduce their supply of water. Yet the ocean does not swell up during the rainy season, nor does it dry up in the hot summer. In the same way, a saintly devotee who has accepted the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the goal of his life sometimes will receive by providence great material opulence, and sometimes he will find himself materially destitute. However, such a devotee of the Lord does not rejoice in a flourishing condition, nor is he morose when poverty stricken. So the ocean is, so much is coming into it, so much is coming out, and sometimes the ocean gets so much water, sometimes it loses. So in life, sometimes we get great opulence and sometimes we lose it. So the devotee is not disturbed or elated. like the ocean. Purport, a sincere devotee of the Lord is always eager to meet the Lord and render him transcendental service. He wants to remain fixed as an atom at the lotus feet of the Lord because Lord Krishna or Narayana is the reservoir of all pleasure. He rejoices when experiencing pure Krishna consciousness and is morose when Krishna is not present in his mind. In his dealings with the material world, a devotee cannot be disturbed by ordinary materialistic people who sometimes insult him and accuse him of neglecting material sense gratification, just as the ocean cannot be disturbed by the innumerable rivers that enter into it. Sometimes lusty women approach a pure devotee, and sometimes speculative philosophers try to argue against the personality of Godhead. But with all such ordinary people, a pure devotee is detached and undisturbed in his blissful Krishna consciousness. So let's read what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says about verse 6. Actually, devotees of Lord Hari who are fixed in devotional service feel the sweetness of that service and lament when they feel a lack of devotional service. So that's when they are elated, and when they lament, they also are happy and distressed, but their happiness and distress is different. They're happy when they're fixed and they feel the sweetness of their service, and they lament when they feel a lack of service. So that is the happiness and distress of the devotee. Sri Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, he says, it sounds like the last one. The mind of the devotee who is always absorbed in devotional service is unfathomable, like the water of the ocean. Just as the ocean is very deep and therefore insurmountable, foolish conditioned souls are unable to understand the grave heart of a liberated soul. Those who are wise and therefore inclined towards the Lord's service, who desire their own welfare, should become as grave as the ocean by minimizing material activities. They should not become disturbed and restless like ordinary foolish people. Although the water of innumerable rivers constantly fills the ocean, it remains unchanged, just as devotees of the Supreme Lord, who are liberated souls, never are disturbed even in the midst of a calamity. So that's the same as the last one. So we'll stop here. It's 12. Do we have any questions on these? We have the ocean. And here you have the mind again.
What was unshakable?
Like the ocean, the pure devotee.
I know.
Unshakable? Okay, let's see. I was reading Bhakti Siddhanta. Liberated souls who are not disturbed even in the midst of a calamity.
Who are not disturbed?
Yeah. Unshakable. Any questions or comments on this? Oh, wait a minute. I think I have something from Satyaraj here. Yes. Oh, he has a very good point here. In this verse, a saintly person has mastered the art of remaining equipoised in happiness and distress, but here's the but: unless one practices throughout one's life, the qualities of detachment and indifference to worldly phenomena will not develop. So practice, we have to practice. Then he quotes Bhagavad Gita 12th chapter, Adveshta Sarvabhutanam Maitrakarana Evacha, and also 13, 14, and 18, 19. Then he comments, we should endure all karma, whether good or bad, aware that it is our due, embracing it graciously. So that was a nice... Yes?
Bhaktisiddhanta, you mentioned that this vision of the whole world as one's guru is the vision of the Mahabhagavata.
Vision of Mahabhagavata.
And sometimes we are discouraged imitating Mahabharata.
Right.
So what would be an imitation of these practices?
Okay, what would be an imitation of a Mahabharata? What would be an improper practice? Well, we heard in our discussion of the three levels of Vaishnavas, if somebody tries to preach to a faithless person, means you see, okay, this everyone's a devotee, but you're not on that level. And then you try to preach to someone who will simply commit offenses, thinking that you're a Mahabhagavat, and you're seeing in him the Krishna in everyone's heart, and so you try to preach to him, and then he makes offenses. So that would be one example that I remember now, that when we had our discussion on the three levels of devotees, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was criticizing this type who just pretends to be a Mahabhagavat, seeing everybody equally, everybody's a devotee, or everybody can be a devotee, and then he goes to preach to an atheist or an offensive person who simply does not want to hear and just makes offenses. So that's one example of imitating, seeing everywhere, seeing equally.
And with regards to seeing trees and snakes and all these as gurus, can one do it improperly?
Yeah, well, Prabhupada said you should not embrace the tiger.
You don't go
embrace the python. Oh, you are my guru. I will give you dakshina and he will eat you. Yeah. That's an example of, you go to the python. Yes, I'm worshipping you as my guru now. Oh, very good. I will take my dakshina. Yes. Yeah, Rasagananda. He was Mahabhagavat. You go to your mad elephant and you will be trampled.
Uh-huh.
He finished him.
Yeah. It was in Ukraine, there was one guy who climbed into a lion's cage and shouted something like, God is great or God exists or something.
Oh, he was Christian.
Yeah, and as soon as he entered into the territory where the cubs were, small lions, the lioness just jumped and in split seconds bit through his neck.
Yeah, imitating that. In the Bible there is one such person who could do that. I think his name was Daniel. He went in the lion's den and the lions didn't touch him.
He climbed over the high fence and then
yes, so there's imitation.
She first looked at him and as soon as he just stepped into the
tent, yeah, where the babies were,
jumped and
finish it. Yeah.
And the question in regards to the foolish dedication of family life, you spoke about Satya Raj, really a balanced position.
Right.
But in practice, many times the Buddha are coming there with their distressful situation.
Right.
And so I had one devotee came to me and said, 3 months ago I met a devotee and we fell in love and we did everything together and we were going to marry and 2 months later, just 1 week before marriage, she left with another devotee. and he said to me,
yeah.
What should I do now?
Show him the story.
So I told him that you should learn a lesson from that.
Yeah.
Don't forget it. You should learn a lesson.
Hmm.
And he said to me, you are the first who is telling me not to forget it. Everyone says, all the other devotees are saying to me, just forget it and go on with your life. In a balance.
At the beginning, beginning of the pigeon story, it said that the material attachment causes great suffering. So that's the lesson, actually. Yeah.
By the end of the book, he becomes a little bit more.
Satyaraj? Yeah. I noticed that too when you get to the Jnana Yoga and he's a little bit in the beginning. He's kind of. If they can get to the end, then I guess they could. they can get more direct knowledge. I noticed that too. He has to explain everything and tell them, and as they don't know what this is. He has to explain, and towards the end he gets more heavy. Responsibility born from goodness. Yes.
You stay together.
Right. Right.
You know,
stay together. Motive passion. Okay. He's criticizing the motive passion, not the actual motive goodness.
Not feminine life in itself.
Right.
Is the
past. Yes. For the majority of the people, family life is the past. And they engage in renunciation in the motive passion. It's too troublesome. It's too much trouble. And yeah, the Grihastha Vision team, they have a nice course, and the name of the course is Strengthening the Bonds That Free Us. So their point is that you can use the Grihastha Ashram as a means of liberation. It's an ashram. If it's an ashram, then it's for advancement in spiritual life. Would you like to say something about that?
No,
oh, okay. You're exercising your hand. Okay. Yes. Yeah. All the ashrams are for elevation. And where you're at, yeah? Yes. Yeah. Yes, as a preacher, Hari Purush has noticed that for many people in the West, a little family affection would be a step up from where they are.
I remember hearing a lecture from Jagadish.
Right, you're supposed to develop affection in the Grihastha Ashram. The Python guy. The guy who... Our Python man?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He
grabbed your umbrella.
I smiled. He smiled. And then he let me go. He did it a few times.
He was testing you. To see if you get angry. Yeah. So now we have our own example here in Braj of the Python. Yes?
We can use this Python technique when we get less food. Prasadam is not there. We have to say, okay, I'll take it. Thank you.
We can use the Python technique when we get less food. Remember that when you don't get enough, then remember the Python. Remember your guru, the Python. You look like you get enough. Yes.
No one in Vrindavan goes hungry.
Yes, that's a fact. That's what Krishna said. No one in Vrindavan goes hungry.
That's why we have so many labor classes coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody goes hungry. It's a fact. Okay, we'll stop here.